Welcome to Serves You Right. This is Andrew, and I'm glad you can make it. If you are a server, a bartender, back house warrior, this is the spot for you. Follow me as we try and work out one fundamental question: whether or not you can truly be happy working in the service industry. With everything involved in working in service, the alcohol, late nights, low wages, restaurants and bars offer a very strange blend of challenge and opportunity to a large, underserviced portion of the population. Are they flawed and ugly in some ways? Absolutely. The service industry does also serve a deep and fundamental human need, though. That drive for fast, flexible work environments, the thrill of quick money, and the appeal of the slightly dangerous. Again, my name is Andrew, and I've worked in restaurants and bars for about 20 years now. I've done everything from dishwashing and bar backing all the way to being a general manager. This is my record of what I've learned, imperfectly, slowly, painfully, and hopefully you find that interesting and you have an easier time at it than I did. All right, let's do it.
Thank you for tuning in again. My name is Andrew, and today we got to talk to James Selby. So, James Selby and I worked together for years in Santa Fe, New Mexico. James was always one of the best wine distributors and wine reps that I ever knew. Expect to learn in this conversation what kind of hours you would expect to work in a wine distribution job. We talk about 40-hour work weeks and how they're kind of a thing of the past. I really particularly enjoyed his discussion of how much his journey and exploration of the Loire Valley really, really impressed him and changed his career trajectory. And we don't shy away from talking about the darker side of hospitality too, the addiction, the burnout, redemption. It's not all bad though. We do talk about some of his proud moments at the compound, including a moment when a couple highly praise his service, some of the best they've ever had. His words, not mine. We do talk about why he quit working in restaurants in the past, and some of his thoughts on the nobility of service, and some of his hopes and dreams for the future. Mentoring the next generation and seeing the next generation of young rising stars come up. So, really fantastic conversation. This gentleman is as real as they get. And yeah, without much ado, let's get into it. This is Andrew Roy, and I hope you enjoy Serves You Right.
Oh, yes. Ooh, that's Zoom. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. So what have you been up to the last couple of years? I haven't really talked to you probably in 7 years until, you know, here and there on Facebook.
Exchanges. Yeah. Well, I retired in the beginning of 2022 from Favorite Brands, or now called L&F, named after the Texas group, the mother group of the company. And I was fine. You know, almost 2 years went by, and a young colleague of mine, somebody like you, I admire and has worked hard and focused on their career, started a new local distribution company called Muse Fine Wine. And that would be Micaela Maestas. You may have, I think she,
oh, you know, she
was you from classes.
She was in La Casa Cena originally, right? That's where I met her.
She works a lot of places. And I first met her, she was at Rancho Encantado, Four Seasons, or I think it was the other hotel at that time, but out there bartending. And I remember walking in and saying hi to her, greeting her, waiting to meet with somebody. And I said, man, this woman has her lights on. And turns out, flash forward 20 years, well, maybe 15 years, she ended up being the GM at Mays, which was Charles Dale's restaurant downtown. And then she worked for several other restaurants. And she went to work for a local distributor here, Fiasco, both as a salesperson, and then later moved to the back of the house, all within the goal that she had to start a distribution company. So she approached me fall of 23 and asked if I would consider helping her get the company started. And because I admire her, as I admire you, and I'll stop blowing smoke up. But, you know, I do, and that's why I'm on this podcast with you. And that gets to some of the things I want to talk about the, in terms of the joy of watching people like you and Michaela grow as professionals in hospitality, which I think is, as you have aptly named your podcast, Serve You Right. Anyway, I agreed and I said, I'll give you at least a year. And that was about not quite a year and a half ago. And I'm about to start stepping back from it a bit now that she's sort of established. And, you know, I am old and I've got things I need to do and want to do, should do. And
things your wife expects you to do.
Yeah, yes. My wife expects me to do. And the joke was originally is, you know, this was going to be part-time, and it is. And we can get to that later when we talk about the realities of the business. But my wife looked at the first paycheck I got and she said, you're putting in a lot of time for this. And I said, look, for me, 40 hours a week is part-time. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what I've been up to. And it's been a lovely journey because of watching her just take on the world, because she's pretty much a one-person band. Outside of, you know, I think of her as Donna Quixote and I'm Pancho, you know, she has done everything. You know, she will receive pallets of wine and put them away by herself. She doesn't want me around to get in her way or to hurt myself and have to pay me for working with cop. I don't know which that is, maybe both. But so that's what I've been up to.
Nice. Yeah.
You know.
No, hopefully less fighting windmills, but yeah.
Yeah.
So far on the podcast, I've talked to several bartenders, chef, also an advocate for mental health in the restaurant industry, but no distributors. So I was going to ask, what do distributors do? What was your job like, and what is it like with this new spot?
It's and this I can only speak about working in New Mexico as a distributor, because I did other things, bartending and serving and managing and owning in other states. But we are what is called a three-tier state. I don't know if that's similar to what you've got in Nebraska or...
Oh, Nebraska's wild. It's the Wild West out here. You can do whatever. They let little kids sit at the bar. It's... Yeah, don't quote me on that, but
it's too late. So a three-tier state basically is the distributor is the middle person, and they work with either an importer for European wines or global wines, or a supplier broker, a broker may work with multiple wineries, and he's sort of the go-between the source of the wine and the distributor. So there's another tier in a way, or a winery directly. Generally that would mean something domestic. Like Muse now works with a wonderful winery in Oregon called Hundred Suns. I don't know if they're available, but like Evan Martin with Martin Woods Winery in the Willamette Valley, the young and up-and-coming stars of the region. So a distributor will sell to restaurants and on and off-premise. So on-premise is restaurants, in case people don't know. And off-premise is where you go and you got to drink it off that premise. You got to go someplace else. Wine shops, independent grocery stores, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the general gist. And And then the distributor has to have salespeople, which is what I've always And I remember when I started distributing, and I started everything late. You know, I had a whole different career into my late 30s, and sort of fell into working in restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. And boom, here I am. So I was working in as a manager and a wine director at a restaurant here when I was approached by a company, one of the large ones, to become a salesperson. At that time, my daughter was in middle school, I think. So she was coming home at 4, you know, and in the restaurant, I was going to work at 4. And I thought, well, here's a day job. Ha, ha, ha. Well, we'll get to that later in terms of real work as a distributor.
Well, on paper, it was a day job, right?
Yeah. Yes. And for the most part, it can be. But that's how I got into distributing.
Yeah. Is that the question? Well, long answers. That's the question that emerged as you were talking about it. Yeah.
Okay.
I do need to put a quick aside. You can probably hear me in the background going, "Oh yes, and yeah." So I'll do my best in the show notes to write down all the lines that you're mentioning that I used to buy from you. So I'm hearing the Martin and all that.
We talked about La Playa, that was one.
Yeah.
And then we talked about mezcals and tequilas. That was another aspect. So, yeah, and then some distributors, you get different licenses. And the one I work for now, Muse, has a wine and spirit. But then some distributors do wine, spirits, and beer, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I focus on wine. That's been my focus pretty much all along.
Well, I mean, it's such a broad topic. It's something that if you're good at, you can really nail down and do it well. And yeah.
Well, yeah. You mean wine is by itself is a broad topic.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you are an example of those up and comings, as up and runnings, up and already doing professionals that have trained with that goal in mind. For me, it was kind of like, oh, I'm managing a restaurant. Oh, you need me to order wine. Oh, okay. So I kind of, as I mentioned, as we were discussing earlier, sort of learned by working the ropes rather than even organized programs or certifications. Which, if I had this knowledge and went back to that square, I would have definitely done what you and Mikhail has done too. And we have a young man in Taos, Tice, who runs the cellar at a wine shop up there, and he's also going for his third. I would have done that, but by the time that became a thing, I was already gray-haired and somewhat pretended to have some knowledge anyway. But, and I know this may be jumping around to different questions you had, but
no, please.
One of the great satisfactions of working in the wine industry is wine. Not drinking it, not excluding it, but the study of it. And the study of that never stops. And even as I retired and I was doing some weekend wine tastings at a Royal Vino, a really fine wine shop and restaurant here, when I retired, the owner, Brian Boxton, said, "Well, why don't you do our Saturday tastings? We're going to, the pandemic is over and we're going to start those up again." So I said, "Okay." So every Saturday, almost for 3 years, I've been doing a consumer tasting for a couple hours at the wine shop there. And what's great about that is I've got homework to do every week. I've got to study each wine. And even though I may have already studied that wine some months ago, I've got to restudy that wine. And then there's other things to study. There's soils, Well, that's a huge topic, right? And then
Yeah.
whole cluster and STEM inclusion. I found out not that long ago that it's not just STEM inclusion. There's the main stem, that comes off of the vine, the main vine. And then there's the stem that goes to the little bunch. And then there's the little individual stems that go to each grape. And each one of those provides something different in the grape, in the wine, in terms of the fermentation. So, like I said, it's a lifelong study, and especially if you're passionate about it, it's fascinating and
For sure.
continuous.
Yeah. No, and there is something that's really lovely about wine. There's a communal aspect to it. You know, the other beverages, you have spirits, it's like a cocktail, and there can be some conviviality at a bar with that. Beer is kind of an individual, you get that bottle, but something about wine, no one sits down and drinks a whole bottle of wine.
Right,
You
because you're
kind of
more
have to
with the
share it.
people around the table. That's a good point. And then with booze, it's communal until you get to your third drink, and then there's a hybrid. And beer, you got to go pee a lot. So I don't know. And I used to love all those things. I was a beer and tequila guy before I fell in love with wine in my early 30s. I had to go to France to do a job. And I thought, well, I'm going to France. Better drink some wine, which I hadn't been doing, So I started about a month before I left, I started drinking a glass a day, and then I increased it to 2 glasses a day. So when I got there, I'd be able to handle my share of wine, and that worked. And then I did a driving tour of the Loire Valley just because I had time and money to do that. And that's what did it. People talk about their aha moments. It was driving on the Loire in late fall, so harvest was over. But you drive along this magnificent river through this countryside that's, well, there's a reason why the kings built chateaus along the Loire Valley, because it's beautiful. Have you been?
I have not.
Well, the other thing that excited me, having been a former actor, which is why I went to France in the first place, was Joan of Arc. That's where Joan of Arc was eventually captured and burned at the stake. And I kept imagining her riding her horse over these beautiful meadow rolling hills and vineyards that lead down to this gorgeous river, which is maybe two-thirds as wide as the Hudson River, but still quite wide and flows so quietly, at least that time of year,
No,
through this valley.
and
And
it
this
is,
600-mile valley
yeah.
with three distinct regions of wine, climate and terroir, basically. Anyway, so that I kept stopping at these little signs to say wine tasting. And it could be a little shack on the side of the road. And I go, oh, yeah, that's good. And buy a bottle and open it, put it between my legs, and drive to the next one. Because in the early 80s, you could do that. You could drive around with a bottle. Well, I don't know if it was legal, but that's what
You still can. It just may not be legal.
did. I don't know. Maybe the rules. Well,
No, that's actually the perfect region for you to get your inspiration. Because when I think of you, I often think of those like nice, food friendly, kind of more refreshing wines. I feel like that was normally what we would taste or talk about together.
When you were, and was this when you were at Ferrol? Yeah, and that it was funny. We were just beginning to work with really some extraordinary Spanish portfolios at that time, and I was discovering wonderful wines from Galicia and the northwest of Spain. Certainly the classic regions, Ribera del Duero and Priorat and Rioja. But then the new Spain wines, from down in Humia or along Rios Baixas, Albarino was not always what it is now. It was like a what? What
Yeah,
is
that's been a
that?
phenomenon of the last 20 years or so.
So, plus, we mentioned La Playa and South America and what was coming out of Argentina and Chile. Very exciting. Wine regions that have been making wine since mission clerics arrived there, as in New Mexico and California, hundreds of years ago. But there's excitement in that region because of, I think a lot of it is not just the passions that obviously we share, but winemakers share, but also just high rent districts. You're getting wines made in Monterey and even in suburbs of Los Angeles and San Diego and that are out of the Gold Coast of California, Napa, Sonoma, and even the Willamette Valley. When I worked at the compound as the wine buyer, and that would have been 2000, mid-2000s, I worked for a general manager that would not allow Willamette Valley wine on the list because he thought they were inferior, and he said that if you wanted to drink Pinot or Chardonnay, if you want to drink those, get them from Burgundy. We don't want anything from Willamette Valley. So the day he was fired, I put six on the list, and haven't looked back because I lived in Portland for a number of years and worked there and spent a lot of time in the wine valley and with winemakers at that time. It's all I follow a blog newsletter from the Willamette Valley now. When I left the Willamette Valley in 2003 to move back to Santa Fe, because I left New York, ended up staying in Santa Fe, intending to go to Los Angeles to do the same crap I was doing in New York, which was, working in restaurants and trying to get acting work. But I stuck in Santa Fe, and that's where I met my wife Leslie, and our daughter was born. A few years later, still a bit antsy being the New Yorker that I had turned into for a while, we moved to Portland and then got into.
Santa Fe's answer to New York, yes.
Right. And, there's sort of a underground railroad of people who say, "I'm going to move to Portland." And then they go, "Oh, Portland is rainy. I'm going to move back to Santa Fe. Ooh, Santa Fe is kind of quiet. I'm going to move back to Portland." Or, other places like Tulsa. And which is, I know, a coming place. I grew up in Kansas, but I didn't spend very much time in Oklahoma because we had Kansas and you had Oklahoma, and they're kind of the same, semi-square, hot, humid.
Right in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Jim, you've mentioned a couple times some past jobs and things you've done. Is there any way I could ask you to kind of give an overview of what you've done in the past? Some of your jobs, places you've lived. I'm very
Sure.
interested. I don't remember in depth what all happened with the acting career.
Well, yeah, I don't mean here. This long ago. I forget whose joke it is. Somebody's joke was, "I started out as a child," and then blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, I grew up in a farm ranch in Kansas, and as soon as I was able to get it to avoid the draft, because I was in the first draft for Vietnam, and I got a very low number. So had I not had a problem with my physical, I would have been over there. And as soon as I could, I graduated from college and had a car packed and went to New York to study and work as an actor. And I did. And I had some good success. And I like to say I went to New York to become a star, but when I got there, I wanted to become an actor. And that's kind of what it was. I mean, a star would have been a different route. And I flew pretty close to the sun a few times. I worked and mostly made my living as an actor for over 20 years there. And people don't really understand all what that means, but basically it means what's called a working actor. You know, you do what you can to make money. Sometimes it's a TV commercial. Sometimes it's a touring show. Sometimes it's a soap opera. Sometimes it's a resident theater in another city. Anyway, that was going along. We don't have time to get into what changed my mind, but you start out at 20 with one set of desires and wishes, and you wake up at 40 and you think, I don't know that I still have that same desire and wish. So I said, I'll try stopping acting and see how that goes. And it went fine. I missed much of it, mostly the literature. As when I retired from selling wine, I missed the study of wine. So something like that. And one of the questions you were thinking of addressing was what I love about the business and or hate about the business of distribution, particularly, was what I love is the people, you know, and the people that make the wine, the people that buy the wine, like yourself, people that are passionate about wine. That's the big part of it. I happened to work in a play, and when it closed, the producer owned a couple of restaurants in New York, and he said, do you need a job? I said, well, yeah, I need a job. And thank God for employment. That is the lifeline for an actor that goes in and out of jobs over the years, because you can keep that perpetually rolling. At least in my day, you could. And, you know, as long as you worked for 20 weeks as an actor in a year, minimum, then you could keep your unemployment going. And that's kind of what I would do, you know. But he said, well, I've got a bar in Greenwich Village, and we'll get you a job there. We'll teach you how to bartend. So I feel so sorry for the bartenders that had to, like, teach me how to bartend, because here I was, the sort of golden boy of this producer, owner of the restaurant, and they were stuck teaching me how to bartend. Anyway, I did that. Worked with Tony Bourdain there, and then another restaurant the same producer owned. He and Tony and I worked at that more upscale restaurant. And it was fine. I enjoyed bartending because it was like show business. You know, you put on your uniform, you get in front of the audience, you have your backstage, you're chasing girls around, whether it's backstage at the theater or, you know, waitresses, or, you know, you're doing all that stuff. And it's a similar livelihood in a way. And then I made the break altogether from the theater, and I stuck around New York for a while. I found I had done some summer stock in upstate New York, and I found a little getaway place that I would go to on my days off. And I thought, well, if I'm spending all my days off in my little summer, fall, spring place, why am I still in New York? I'm not acting. I don't need to be in New York. I could be anywhere. So but I did. While I was in New York, and my last job was at that time, maybe ever, the largest wine bar in the world. It was called the Soho Kitchen and Bar in Soho. And it had one of the first places to use Cuvenet machines. Those are those machines where you can plug a bottle of wine into to take out the cork, and you plug in the cork of the Cuvenet, which has a tube into the bottle, and that's attached to a big tank of nitrogen, and pull the little lever, and out comes wine. And we did flights of wines. We had 110 wines by the glass. That doesn't even count the sparkling wines. That's where I, and by then I'd already been to the Loire, so I was enjoying wine and learning about wine.
And that sounds like a sink or swim sort of place.
Well, yeah, and you know, we were all bartenders, we were all assholes and drinking, you know, they would have a flight of Saint Estèphe or a flight of Pomerols, and some not first gross, but we did have Riesac and other Sauternes, Château-Yquem, So we all on my shift drink, I'll pour a little glass of Château-Yquem. Well, that didn't last very long. And they kind of dumbed down some of the wines on the machine after a while. But at that point, I was just a bartender. I wasn't really thinking of a wine career. And traveling to on my way to LA, I stopped in Santa Fe and was offered a job. And then I became a little more serious about wine because part of that job was buying wine. And
And was this straight at the compound? Or
this was the San Francisco Street Bar and Grill in the old days when it was downstairs. It was just a
yes,
bar and
the
grill.
place. Yeah.
I didn't start. and I kept that job till we left, moved to Portland, and it just so happened that the owner of the San Francisco Street Bar and Grill called me in before I left, already given notice we were already going to leave, and he said, "Oh, you sent a resume to a guy that used to work for me." And this guy's in Portland. He was a GM of fine dining restaurant with one extraordinary wine list. The chef had been a finalist for a Beard Award, and the list, I don't know, I think we had like 11,000 wines. I mean, it would take four of us like 3 or 4 days to do the inventory, because there were so many wine rooms. Except anyway, so I ended up working there, and that really was, yeah. I know we would have this was the heydays of the .com, and we had some dot-commers that would come in and spend, $20,000 on a meal for six people, with some DRC and vintage ports, and suddenly I was like, okay, I've got this $3,000 bottle of port. I got to get out. Anyway, so again, you learn on the job how to decant and how to get a cork out, and then just to finish my career progress, which is a podcast in itself, I opened up a little cafe restaurant, and that was hard. It was satisfying, and one of those things I miss our food, but it was a challenge. We had our first anniversary just as 9/11 hit, and things kind of, the bloom was kind of off, enjoying yourself out on the town, across the whole country, not the world. So that lasted a few years, and eventually you sold it, and had a chance to come back to Santa Fe to open the new San Francisco Street Bar and Grill upstairs. Excuse me. And that's what I did. Came back. And from there, later, I went to the compound. So came back in 2003, and by 2006, I was working at the compound. And then started distribution work probably the fall of 2007 or early 2008.
Now, between that whole progression, is there one that you enjoyed more, or were they all different in their own unique ways? Kind of hard to say.
All those positions, and
You've done a little bit of everything, it sounds like.
yeah, well, I loved bartending. And especially in New York, because they know how to drink and they know how to treat a bartender. And I always said if I found the perfect bartending job, I would have done that all my life. And I remember I was in Los Angeles trying to get some acting work, and we went to the Formosa Cafe, which was a famous Chinese restaurant right across from the original Paramount Studios. And those bartenders looked like me, and I looked like you. And I thought, shit, there's two old guys, and they're three deep at the bar, and the place is jammed. And it was a hot spot for people, young people to go have a drink. I thought I would do that, but that never quite happened. Plus, who knows if my feet would have, legs would have lasted that long. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
So the thing is, I have enjoyed hospitality all the way through. I think part of that, I think because I started later, a lot of people you talk to, started busing when they were 14 or 15, and now they're 35-year-old servers in a bar and grill, and they're not happy. Well, that's their problem, and I can understand
that. Sorry.
But so I started a little later, and, the career, the hospitality stuck. And again, I love the people I've worked with for the most part. Of course, the other side, there's a famous old classic movie called The Night of the Hunter with Robert Mitchum, and he plays this escape serial killer, basically. And at one point, he shows his knuckles, and that's where the original love hate, he's got tattooed on his knuckles. That's, I think, we're creative now, the meme now you see all over the place. But so some of the hate side of hospitality is the people. The people you love, and then the people you never want to see again, or who need their medications, or they're, abusing other things. And you had mentioned talking about that aspect of it. In hospitality, it's available, I mean, I think there are people that are addictive and abusing substances in any profession, whether they're teachers or.
Human beings are going to be human beings.
They're going to be there. But it is, it's cheaper if you're in the restaurant business because it's available for the most part. I've had my issues where I felt like I've got to stop. And so there's a couple of times when I've stopped imbibing. And one time it wasn't because I was having any problem. I was at a wine festival, and I was just enjoying myself. I wasn't like, sometimes that can get kind of loose and wild. Mm-hmm. But I came back from it thinking, nothing really tasted good to me during that whole festival, and there were some great things. So, and then as the days went by, wine just did not appeal to me. So I stopped drinking almost a year, maybe even longer. I would taste and spit if I had to or needed to, and then eventually it came back to me, and the enjoyment of it, and I started again. But there's been times when I've had to check myself, not into an institution, but
no,
which I know people.
Me too. It's a unique thing. It's something I've been trying to figure out and kind of explain. I think it's partially the low barrier to entry, to where you can kind of go out and get a job at any point, if you know what
yes.
I mean. So the barrier and concern about messing up the job you have kind of drops out too.
Yeah.
And so if you miss a few days because you're hungover, like, that is a little bit less of a stigma. And I think I saw more in Tulsa and more in Omaha than in Santa Fe, thanks to Santa Fe being so small.
But maybe. I always, always found it odd that the same mess ups, if I'm not using the F word, that have a new job every 3 to 6 months continue to be hired here in Santa Fe, when everybody knows, I guess you just need a warm body behind the bar or on the floor, so you hire this person. And it's like, what are you thinking? So there is that area of, almost forgiveness, or What is it when you help an addict along? What's the word they use?
Oh, enabling.
Enabler,
Yeah.
enabling restaurant owners to just hire these people because you.
Well, I think there's also something about the restaurant owners themselves occasionally. I feel like some people get into the restaurant industry because of the atmosphere. It's easy to sit around and have a couple of glasses of wine at the end of every night if you own a restaurant. Less so if you own an insurance firm or something like that, you know?
Like I was saying,
Yeah.
it's available and it's at your fingertips. Yes, and again, those are the these are some of the negative things, but I do want to address absolutely the some of the positive things
Oh,
because
sure, yeah.
I mean I know you do too, and I made some notes because there was a lot of positive things, but
Yeah.
just especially with distributing, because you asked one of your three questions was, talk about your typical week. And I say in general, there's not a typical week. There might be a outline to the week. And you think again, you got a day job Monday through Friday. That doesn't count wine dinners. That doesn't count in-store tastings, consumer tastings. When your best liquor wine shop says, "Can you do a 3-hour tasting on Saturday?" It gets you out of yard work in spring, which I used to like. And then there's just distributing, particularly to focus on that, was to me has always been a concession. It's like you can put your hot dog cart on the corner of 57th and 5th Avenue by Tiffany's. And if you show up for a couple of hours, you'll sell a few hot dogs. But if you're there throughout the day, you're going to sell a lot of hot dogs. And that's the way it is with distribution. You get out of it what you put in. And to me, that meant. And I say because I wasn't particularly talented, so in a lot of ways, I spent more hours to make up for that lack of, any real serious knowledge or ability or talents. Maybe that just came across well. But I spent a lot of time. I was probably working, when I was at the sort of peak earning and success, I guess, in my years, I was putting in 70 to 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
And some of those would have been, I get up early, so I'd be on my computer with my cup of tea from 6 to 9, and then take a shower and get dressed and work the market from 10 to 6, and then maybe have to make a stop or pick up something here or there or drop off something here or there and get home at 7, So right there's what 13, 14 hours, and that's just a normal day. And that doesn't count Sundays where, okay, I got Monday coming up, so I gotta figure out what I'm gonna do and who I can hit to taste and if I've got a rep in town or a winemaker or a distributor or a importer, because they come to town. And depending on who you work for, with favored brands, we had a lot. And they wanted to come to Santa Fe, A, because people wanted to come to Santa Fe, and B, because they want more wine to be sold. So they show up, and you have to escort them around during your week. So you have your normal week, and then you have your week with the. So you're working kind of two jobs. You're the host to the guests. Winemaker, and you got to make a nice, you want to make a good impression. You want to get them to the good accounts. You want to hopefully sell some of their wine. You want to introduce them and get your customers excited about their wine and meeting this winemaker. So, yeah, it's a lot of work, but the more you put in, the more you get back. And I don't know what an attorney's life is like. I know when I was particularly in New York bartending, I served a lot of attorneys because it was sort of in the downtown area near Wall Street and in City Hall. And I cannot tell you how many lawyers came in and would say, "Man, I want to be a bartender, this law work, and I think, there's it kind of depends on where you are in your career as a lawyer. If you're starting out as an associate, you're going to work your 80 hours, 90 hours a week too. And it's the same, as you get more experience, you can kind of control some of that and funnel it into, knowing your accounts.
And I do think, I really like what you said there, the variability of it and all those examples you gave. That is a big plus. That's something, my wife, she wanted me to say hi, so I didn't want to forget.
Well, hi,
Yes.
Ann. Yeah,
So
wonderful human.
she got out of restaurants and she's actually production coordinator for a casino now, works from home. But there's this regularity to her hours and what she does. And
Yes.
she's 40 hours a week, and that's it. And like, you shall not pass the lines. And
Yeah. And
she's,
it's remote, right? So that's what
yep.
my wife does for an attorney and that she still works for when she worked for him when he lived in Portland. But you got to be disciplined to do that. And I'm sure Anne is. And Leslie is, yeah, she'll spend her 6 to 7 hours, but then she'll jump up and do a load of laundry, or she'll jump out and, do a little gardening and get back, or she'll run in and do an errand and come back. And,
Yes.
or she'll get down on her yoga mat and do her exercises. It would be harder for me to do. So,
Well, I see in myself the possibility of future where I didn't end up in restaurants, but I ended up as like an accountant. And I could see
really?
that lawyers use something intellectual that is a
Yeah.
lot of reading and math and just kind of
What
boring.
about
And I could see,
consulting?
oh, I mean, maybe, but.
I don't know if that's as much a thing as it used to be, but and it requires, also some travel and also some time, depending on the jobs. But I've worked with several people who were restaurant consultants, and they would come in, help a restaurant get launched, help a build out design a bar, for instance. I always thought that was the worst part about taking a bartender job in any restaurant, let alone a new one, was that somebody obviously never worked behind a bar when they built this bar. Just a complete mess. So I had an old bartender friend that did that for a number of years. He would design, consult on building bars. And there's other kinds of consulting, but
Well, I was more saying I could see a future if I'd never worked in restaurants there, I would have worked a job without human interaction, without variability, and
oh, I
I
see.
like ended up a very
You're
boring and bored
not leaning in
person.
that
Yes.
direction now. I see. I see.
No,
Or
yeah.
Andrew's going to be an accountant, but no.
No.
Yeah, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I was at a crossroads because I'd been focused as, a career as in acting, and then there was in. But you were right. I thought, I'm tall, well spoken. I can get a job anywhere as a bartender, and that's pretty much what I did, and then got more serious about it.
Well, there's something inherently exciting, I think, and fun in restaurants, even if they do have the long hours and all the extra stuff that comes along,
That's true.
where other jobs, I mean, every job has its own thing, right? And
Yeah.
there's something that's not going to be good, but
Yeah,
yeah.
like I said, it's kind of like show business. You're on stage for several hours, and then you can go back to the waiter station and say, "Oh my God, I just got ripped off, and those people don't know what they're doing, but they won't stop talking." Anyway, and it can be fun, and yeah, it can be long. And again, if you're a server, There are a few of those, and I know I met a couple of them when I was recently in Atlanta and went to one of the classic diners that, you know, Martin Luther King would go to and Jimmy Carter would go to, and that waitress seemed to have the right end of the stick because she seemed, she wasn't, you know, she was joyful and helpful and cheerful. And, you know, she's been working in that place since she was probably 18 years old, and now she's probably closer to retirement age. And that's great. That's one of those jobs, you know. But if you're working doubles, yeah, the thing about doubles is you got to change your shoes between the shifts. That's what I would recommend. And I found in my doubles, like the compound in those years, they had a tile floor. So now they have carpet. In those days, a tile floor for, and you're there from 10 in the morning until 12 at night. Yeah, mm-hmm. Change your shoes.
I do the 10-hour shifts in dress shoes. So right. I don't know where I would keep a change of shoes.
Well, yeah, you got to find time to just do it.
Is there anything that ties together the people that you've seen do well in this industry?
It ties together the people I what?
Have seen do well in this industry?
Cool.
Common characteristics or?
Passion is one, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, you can have a career in hospitality and just have a business mind, you know, like Danny Meyer. I don't know if he's passionate about restaurants or not, but, you know, he's got that mind for business. Yeah, enjoying, again, I think you've got to enjoy people because it is a people business. Mm-hmm. And I there's another aspect that you brought up about the nobility of service. And I follow Aldo Sohm, who's the wine director at La Bernardin and has his own wine bar in New York.
Okay.
He's on Instagram. Every Wednesdays, he does the, you know, Wine Lesson Wednesday. He does about a 45-second blurb about how to decant or how to read a German wine label or how to store wine. And he seems to be the real deal. Well, he is the real deal. He's at the top of his profession. But also, he's a biker, and he goes to Europe, and he bikes around Europe, and he bikes around, you know. So he has a life as well. And that's the other side of a long career is you got to find something to, you know, release the pressure besides drugs and alcohol and sex and things like that. And for me at one point, it still is a bit, but writing, you know, I was back here opening a new restaurant and pressure was immense and, that's, I think, the hardest thing in the industry is to open a new restaurant. It can be...
For some reason, I've done it several times. I don't know why.
Yeah. And do you find it as difficult and stressing as...
Every time I remind myself I shouldn't do it again, and then I do it again. Yeah.
Well, sometimes you have to.
It's exciting. Yeah.
It can be exciting, and especially when you get launched. But I would... So I found if I got up, you know, 45 minutes earlier and spent some time just jotting down some things just for my personal self, that helped. And I find that you, and it's exercise too, you know, and it's hard to get that lesson across to sometimes young people who don't necessarily need to exercise because they're young, you know, they're 22, 23. They can drink, I did, you know, drink all night long, get 2 hours of sleep, go to an exercise class and go work a double and do it all over again. But
oh, you know, I miss those days.
They can't be too far behind you.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, take care of yourself mentally and whatever it is, whether it's, you know, exercising or meditating or going to an art museum, do something, you know.
Well, that's Yeah, that's really cool. Actually, I don't think I've talked to anyone about this, but a couple years ago, I read a book, Storyworthy, by Matthew Dicks, and he actually recommends a daily writing practice in
Oh,
that. And he
name again?
talks, it's Storyworthy,
Story worthy.
Matthew Dicks. So
Okay.
he, really good storyteller. He describes it as doing your daily homework. And I was always good at school, so that didn't scare me away.
Yeah, great.
I just write a
Yeah.
couple like quick nonsense things, and sometimes I
Right.
type, sometimes longhand, but
Right. Just
yeah.
take that time to record some. This is a creative business, and when you're working on it, you got to focus your creativity mostly on the business, whether you're a server or you're a SOM or a manager. It's nice to be able to apply that creativity, imagination, and there's a spark of life, a spark of the human spirit, life force.
And not only that, sometimes the emotions that arise from interacting with other humans, and a few of the notes are like, Sarah said that Jamie's, and it's all the things that I couldn't say out loud to coworkers or colleagues. And yes, so there's a record of that present somewhere.
And bouncing around now as we are. I mean, I also just you asked me about proud moments in
I was going to ask.
my career, and one of them was just simple. I was working at the compound as the wine director, and I had this couple that would come in pretty regularly. I think they traveled, but they would be in once a month and twice a month, maybe. They always requested the same table. And actually, when I first met them, I was just a captain. I wasn't doing the wine service yet, but they always requested me. And this went on, a year or so, and I would serve them. And at one point, I had become the manager and wine director, which is, gosh, too bad. The best was when I was just the wine director. That was a golden period. But then when I had to both be the GM and the wine director, that was quite as much fun and much more work. But I was serving them one night, and they liked Burgundy, some kind of Premier Cru, or maybe the Grand Cru, and I was serving them, and we were just chatting. And we'd chat briefly when they would come in, but nothing out of the ordinary. And they were world travelers, and the gentleman, he kind of reminded me of Harry Dean Stanton, if Harry Dean Stanton were a gentleman of the world, as opposed to the kind of scrabbly artist that he was. And she was quite a beauty, a little bit younger than he was, but both just lovely human beings. And he said, we eat all over the world. That's what we do. We travel and we dine in restaurants. And he said, we've never had a server or better service from anyone better than yourself. And I thought, wow. I had some experience at fine dining and other things, and of course, but that to me was, I'm choked up, not because of that, well, a little bit, but that to me was a really proud moment of having received that kind of, they didn't have to tell me that, they always left a good tip and whatever, and I enjoyed that. But that was a moment that I continue to carry with me, because that's the thing about this business, I mean, the hospitality business. And whether it's Aldo Sohm, who's Austrian, I think, originally, and probably went up the ranks through that kind of schooling that they,
The European
in
nobility,
Europe,
yes.
it's a respected profession, and it can be here too. And I get sorry and disappointed sometimes when I see people I understand not choosing it as a profession, and when you're just trying to get through college and get on to something else. But I guess I was pretty disappointed during the pandemic when there was such backlash of from servers about working in restaurants and about how badly they were treated and how poorly the industry treats people, et cetera, et cetera. And there are instances of that, and there certainly are instances of abuse, sexual and otherwise. But I thought, wow, here you have a chance to work 6 or 7 hours a night if you're a server, or maybe longer, 8 or 10 if you're a bartender. Make a really good living working 3 to 4, maybe 5 nights a week if you need more money, and go away and come back. Yeah, maybe you don't have insurance, unless you're in a management position. But you also don't have many other restrictions or ties to it. It's an opportunity. You don't have to do it. You don't have a, but it's paying your rent and allowing you to go to school or to ski during the day, if that's what your passion is. But I don't know if you've where were you in Oklahoma during the height of the
I was in Tulsa.
COVID? Did you experience that kind of lashing back, and especially on social media?
I saw a lot of it. I think that from what I could see, a lot of it was a little more intense in Santa Fe, because at least I had the benefit of having a lot more of Texas and Oklahoma in my feed, just because I grew up there and then lived in Oklahoma at the time. I think in New Mexico, there's kind of a sense that that's largely the only option for a large portion of the population, because it is so tourist driven. A lot of the other industries don't have a
True.
lot of options, you know?
That could be true. And also, I don't know what the minimum wages was in other states. It was pretty low, So, but your tips, the system was your tips would amount to more than a minimum wage. So you were earning more than a minimum wage nearly. Anyway, I saw a restaurant, some restaurant owners sort of vilified or in places I thought that was unfair.
Oh, yeah. And just to be fair, I did have even my share of people that had issues or a little trepidation, a little re hesitancy in coming back. And like, I get it. It was a period. So I got into the advanced test during that same time and I canceled because it wasn't clear what was going to happen. And so I pushed it back a year because
Wow, because
at the
you had
beginning,
to be around.
yeah, well, they were having it, I think it was May or June, and I just, you don't know. And everything was shutting down. I didn't know if I'd have a job at the beginning, like most people,
Yeah,
there
that
was
was
a
a,
lot. I think
yeah.
people fear uncertainty more than a lot of things. And if there's one thing about COVID, it was a lot of uncertain for a
Yeah,
long
and
time.
certainly in the hospitality business, yeah. But anyway, I don't disregard the sensitivities and I have a lot of people who went through difficult times, and as you said, if you've got few options, that's hard.
I do have a lot of, a lot of joy and hope for the future, because I feel like
Good.
every generation has some weird thing, and we got COVID, so hopefully
Yeah.
that's it. No more news, no more. No. But we'll see.
As they say in New York, from your mouth to God's ear.
I do want to say the story you told about the couple in the compound. I love that.
Oh,
That's,
thank you.
I feel like a large portion of the modern era is just looking for people to actually pay attention to them, for someone to see them and actually
Yeah.
be there with them. And so I feel
And
like when they
having
see someone like you.
have an equal exchange in a way of humanity. That's kind of my new thing of calling people a good human, but thank you. I
Well,
appreciate it.
even more today, 20 years later, we're all so in our heads and we're got our iPhones right here, and it's just, it seems like just getting out a little bit and paying attention to the other person is half the battle.
Yeah, and I think that goes for not just our work or anyone's work, but also, when you're in the grocery store or you're, shopping for a t-shirt or something, to
Well, I don't want to be disrespectful of your time. Do I have time for one more question or?
Sure.
Sure.
Have
I
you?
was wondering, where do you think you would have ended up, or do you think things would have been different had you not met your wife?
Oh, that is some, honestly, someone should do a podcast called "That's a Good Question." Maybe somebody has. Probably everything's been thought of, I got really lucky meeting the woman I've met, Leslie. She is a human dynamo. She's brilliant. She's funny. She was has been an amazing mother to our kid, and she's a bit younger, so she's still working full time. That's why she's important at a law firm. And it's hard. She's working hard, but she wakes up generally cheerful if she's had a good night's sleep and just dives into it. I'm to be more specific, if it hadn't been Leslie. I've been lucky in my life with gravitating to good partners, and who knows? I don't expect it would have changed my career at all. Whether I would have stayed in Santa Fe or come back after we left, I don't know. I really enjoyed Portland, but I know the pandemic and the political scenes for the last few years there has changed the certainly the downtown area. The downtown in those days was wonderful and really spectacular to spend time in a downtown of a city not that long ago. And then I became at one point, I remember asking her again, she was younger and just over 30, and when we met, and I turned 30 after we met. And I said, "Well, do you want to do some traveling?" Because she hadn't done much traveling, and I hadn't done that much, but, or do you want to have a kid? And she thought for a while, and she said, "I think I want to have a kid." So that, who knows if I'd been a father, which has been really satisfactory, the greatest privilege in a life. And there's many privileges to be had in any life, but this has been one of them. So I don't know. I don't
It's
think.
hard to can't split test life, right?
Another compliment in my career is having you contact me and said, "Hey, I want to talk to you." Me? You sure? I know. You may go back over this and say, "Oh, God."
No.
Delete, 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 cut, cut, cut. But,
No, I feel like, I've always had the greatest respect for you, so thank you
thank
for making the time and
you. It's been mutual because, again, that's what excites me about having achieved this. A man of a certain age, as my nephew says, and seeing people like you and Michaela and others. There's a young guy here named Simon, who's doing the right thing, and that's, you're the professionals. You will be driving the profession and the industry from here on, and that's very gratifying to see. And good for you for achieving it, because it takes work.
Well, all the tastings that you held definitely helped, especially with my studies back in the day. All the
Well,
times you sat at the bar at El Farol and had a bite to eat definitely helped out too.
I know those were some good connections too.
Well,
All right.
hey, I'm not gonna hold on to you all day. Yeah, so I'm gonna let you have a good
Like
day. Is it
who held on to who, so.
no.
Yeah.
Hey,
It's
if you ever want to talk, feel free to reach out, and thanks for taking the time to sit down and
okay.
chat with us.
Yeah, we'll keep the connection going.
Thanks. Talk to you
Okay.
soon, James.
Bye, buddy.
Hey, thank you for taking the time to listen. If you enjoyed this today, please leave a review. Even just one moment to like the podcast really helps other people discover our show. Hopefully people that need to hear this message find this. And thank you again, everyone who listens. You are my people. Keep rocking on. Have a great service. Please come check us back. We send out new episodes every Tuesday. Rock on. Cheers.